Hello, science enthusiasts. Welcome again to the Science Podcast. This is episode 14 of season one. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, and you'll hear my other family members chime in from time to time. And Bunsen Burner, the Twitter science dog, is our family doggo. Bunsen has an enormous social media following, and he's part of what's called Dog Twitter. Dog Twitter is the fuzzy, feel-good place you go if you've had a rough day. You should check it out. There's so many great dog accounts to follow. Bunsen's just one of them. Speaking of following Bunsen, he's on Twitter at BunsenBurnerBMD. He's on Facebook and Instagram at BunsenBurner.BMD. The podcast will always be free. You never have to worry about paying for it. It does incur some costs. As such, we've set up a Patreon to help cover some of the costs. You can check it out at Patreon.com/BunsenBurner. The lowest tier, it's only $5 a month. This week's episode is going to be amazing. We're going to be talking about dogs and dog science. We've got some really interesting and timely science news, and our guest will blow your mind. He's Matt Nelson from We Rate Dogs and Thoughts of Dog on Twitter. The discussion with him is both fascinating and really heartfelt as he talks about the ups and downs of running such an enormous Twitter account and the impact that it has on millions of people's lives. It's a fascinating discussion. Well, Bunsen, should we get right to the program and talk about some dogs and talk about some science? All right. You heard the word. Well, the bark. There's no time like science time. This week in science news, we're going to be talking about a fairly shocking story and meta-analysis of bird species that has been a buzz on Twitter the last couple weeks with the people who are bird experts. But because it's kind of a heavy topic, I thought I would tell you a funny Bunsen bird story before we get to it. And here it is. We have owls at our property. We're not quite sure what they are yet. I think they're these types of owls called northern hawk owls. But when we took a video of the owl to a biologist at the Ellis Bird Farm, which is this really cool place nearby, she thought that they were great horned owls. They're juveniles. And I guess time will tell because they haven't grown the horns yet, the big furry horns. They don't actually have horns like a, they don't have horns like a goat. So we're not quite sure what they are. Anyways, why this has a connection to Bunsen is that for the first time in a while, we've had owls. And when we were out on a hike with Bunsen, when I was out on a hike with Bunsen, I saw a couple owls flitting about, and one looked like it crashed on the ground. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's terrible. Bunsen saw it too, and he was super curious, and he kind of like pranced over there. And he was keeping his distance, but he wanted to go and see it. He wasn't going to hurt the owl, guaranteed. I don't think he was going to hurt the owl, but he was really curious about it. And the owl had puffed itself up and had its like wings out, and it was making like this clicking sound, this warning click. And maybe Bunsen thought, oh, it's going to play. So he got too close to it, and it like jumped at him. It did this hopping flap jump. And it just about got him with his claws. And then he kind of like dodged it. He didn't bark or anything. He didn't. He went away from it and he just stood there. And he just stood there looking at the owl like incredulous that it attacked him. Like, what's the matter with you, bro? I was just going to play with you. And the owl just stared him down with the freaky owl eyes that owls have. No, owls are super cute. Even though this owl was very upset with us, it's pretty cute. And, okay, so I grabbed Bunsen. He's off-leash because I take him off-leash on our property and kind of grabbed him and took him away from that owl. He's like, okay, whatever. We took three steps more, and another owl crashed right next to us. What is wrong? I was like, are these owls poisoned? I didn't know what was happening. So, of course, I'd let go of Bunsen by then. He was off-leash, and he was more wary this time. He gave the owl lots of space, but he really wanted to take a look at it. And we later learned they were learning to fly. They were like adolescent teenage owls crashing. They were crashing because they didn't know how to fly. They would go for a little bit and just like kind of boom. And so maybe we startled them as we were walking through the forest and they tried to get away and then realized they couldn't fly. And both of them crashed within meters of us. It was the craziest day, the day of owls. So that's our bird story. And that will be a good segue into the news story about birds. You know, and while it's a little disheartening and it's a little sad, the more we know about issues, while they are sad, while they are perhaps depressing, it lets us think about our actions for the future. So the science news this week is a meta-analysis of a whole host of bird species, basically all of the bird species across North America, has found that we've lost 3 billion birds since 1970. And the loss of these birds is across all bird types. So not just your generalist bird types, but rare birds as well. To add some specifics to the story, scientists have always known that birds have had a rough go because humans have encroached on their habitat. We keep building into places that they used to live. And we have lots of feral cats and just household cats that eat a ton of birds. It is shocking how many birds get eaten by cats. Added to that, bird collisions with windows, bird collisions with vehicles. That's a lot of birds. So what does it mean to lose 3 billion birds? Well, the stat is even more shocking when you think of the total bird numbers. That's a loss of 30%. One in three birds since 1970. So conservationists, ecologists, and bird experts are all a little stressed out about this number, as they should be. Peter Mara, a conservation biologist who works at Georgetown University in Washington, was quoted in the study in the story saying that this is a total wake-up call. We are experiencing an ecological crisis. One of the things that another ecologist was talking about from the University of Santa Barbara, Hillary Young, is that it's sad that the birds are lost. Like, you think about that loss and it's quite staggering, but what do birds do for our ecosystem? Well, they pollinate plants and they disperse seeds and they control pests. Like, they eat insects, they help pollinate our fruits and our flowers. One, yeah, it's terrible that that many birds are gone. There's a cascade effect because of their loss. And this is the first time they've known the extent of the loss. So these researchers took a look at a whole bunch of databases built from tons of on-the-ground bird observations and then took a look at it year by year by year up until recent times. And what they found from bird sightings, tagging, all of the stuff that goes into bird science and counting them is that most of the loss has come from migratory birds because of their loss of habitat. And that's the grassland species. So as cities have moved out into areas where these birds used to live, they've fared the worst. Now, I don't know how to relate this to my life or our life out here in Alberta on the farm. I put up bird feeders and we get a crazy amount of birds that come and eat at the bird feeders. But I'm just one case, right? Like, just because I see lots of birds, that doesn't correlate, that doesn't extrapolate to the world at large. And one of the birds that are kind of annoying for us are sparrows. Now, this is the study looked at American sparrows. We don't really like sparrows because they kill bluebirds for us. We have these little cute little bluebirds and the sparrows get rid of them and we want to keep them around. But anyways, sparrows dropped by 750 million over that timeline. That's insane. If you look at other invasive species like starlings, which are generalists, they didn't evolve in that area. They're not native to that area. They were brought to a new area, and because of their advantages, because of where they evolved or where they were naturally selected, they had huge advantages over the species that live in that area. So they're highly adaptable. So these starlings are really good at coming in and moving into other territories. Plus, starlings are generalists, which means that they can live in a broad range. Like, there's some types of birds, for example, that can only live in the top quarter of spruce trees in Alberta. Like, they're just these specific warblers that only live in the top quarter of a tree. But starlings can live pretty much wherever they want. And starlings had a decline in population of 63%. One of the things that they are using to help track birds recently is radar. So the radar now can pick out flocks of birds from the sky and distinguish it from something like a cloud. So that's also helped kind of pinpoint the number of species that have declined. And that's even within the last decade. So like 10 years, there's been a 14% drop in migratory birds using that radar technique. What this study doesn't do is address specifically the reasons why so many birds are being lost. However, if you talk to anybody who is studying birds, any bird experts, zoologists, specialists, people who study birds, the main thing they're going to say is it's habitat degradation. So as habitats go away, birds don't have anywhere to go. So the ones that can move do. And some of the specialists, they have no other adaptations to live in any other area than, say, the grassland. They can't live in a tree. They can't live in a city. They can only live in the grassland. They're only adapted to that area. But also the generalists, as they move into areas with greater risks. They move into cities. They move into areas with cats. They move into areas with cars and big buildings. As they get pushed out, their numbers go down too. So here's some hope, and maybe the hope comes from Canada. There are some species of birds that have actually gone way up in population, and that's the ducks and the geese that live in Canada. They, if it's hard to believe, but they've gone up 56%. Now, why is this a big difference? Why has waterfowl done okay? In fact, better than okay than all of the other types of birds. And there's a direct correlation with conservation efforts. Billions of dollars were put in to protect birds and their habitats. Millions in Canada to protect areas where they migrate to protect areas where they, you know, they go to water, so that we really protect these birds in Canada, the waterfowl, and in the United States too. So that gives you hope, right? While the numbers are staggering and the numbers, the losses are just like really disheartening, with human intervention and the use of targeted money to protect habitats, we can reverse this. This is not irreversible. It's not like all of the birds are extinct. I mean, it's bad, but just like we've seen with waterfowl, there is hope, right? There's great hope if we all act together. And that's one of the cool things about science. Yes, some science facts are distressing, but when we know those facts, when we know there's a problem, solutions can be made, and we can come together to fix the problem. And maybe it won't just be me and Bunsen looking at owls and all the little birds that we have at our bird feeders and bird boxes. Maybe we can expand, you know, everybody around the world can think about that. So in closing, one of the things that the paper said, this research paper doesn't tell us what the future holds, only what's happened up until this point. And because it doesn't tell us what the future will hold, it's up to us to decide what to do to affect that future. That's science news for this week. This week in dog science, we're going to be taking a look at an interesting study that seems to point out that some of our love of dogs may be beyond our control and may be genetic, meaning you may not have any control over your love for dogs, which is really hilarious. You know, some people are dog people. You might have heard that before. People say, I'm a dog person. Well, what does it mean to be a dog person? Well, for me, I'm a dog person. And other people may have no control over the fact that they don't like dogs. So, sociologists and psychologists have long known that our childhood shapes our adulthood, right? What happens when we're little shapes our entire childhood. And, you know, I didn't have a dog growing up, but I loved them. I absolutely loved dogs. When I was growing up, I just adored dogs. My grandparents had a dog named Rocky. It's the earliest memory I have of a dog. And he was like a German Shepherd mix. And I just remember just how awesome it was to have a dog follow you around. He was really protective of us. So when we went out to their farm, he would trail behind us and make sure we were all okay. And that was my earliest memory of a dog. And since that time in my life, I've just remembered that I've always loved dogs. Even as a young adult, I loved dogs. We got our first family dog when I was in grade 11 or 12. And his name was Gwyn. And he's sadly been gone for a while. He was a mix, probably a Basenji mix. And then for a time while I was in university, I just didn't have the money or time for a dog. I was very, very, very busy. But I would see them, and I was that crazy person that would run across the street to say hi to a dog. And it wasn't until my family settled down and we had a stable career and stable money that I figured it would be appropriate to bring a dog into our family. And that's when we got our golden Callan, a little puppy, a little golden retriever. The love affair with dogs continues to this day with Bunsen, who our whole family just adores. We just dote on this dog. He's the most spoiled dog in the world. I think everybody's dog is the most spoiled dog in the world. Okay, so where and why is this part of dog science? Well, speaking of childhood, maybe there's a little bit more to why we love dogs than just what happens when we're little. Maybe the love of dogs is in our DNA. Where this is coming from is a Swedish study took a look at a huge amount of twins, just about 100,000 twins. That's a lot of twins. That's a lot of twins. And the reason why they do twin studies is that twins, identical twins, are clones of each other. They have identical DNA. Not fraternal twins. We're talking about identical twins. What happens with one twin, there's a huge correlation with what happens to another identical twin. So there's a lot to do with our behaviors that are rooted within our DNA. So they took a look at all of these twins for 15 years of dog ownership. So they took a look at twins who had dogs and twins that didn't have dogs. And they ran it through a computer model to identify patterns. So they were looking to see if there was a genetic influence or if there was an environmental impact that shaped a person's love of the canine. And it came out pretty interesting. They found that genetics were more important in selecting dog ownership than the environment. It's actually higher in women. 57% more likely to have a dog based on the genetics. So what does it mean to run it through a model to compare genetics versus environment? Well, they looked at these twins that when they were little, they had dogs. So maybe it was their environment that shaped their love of dogs. So they had dogs growing up. And then they looked at them as an adult to see if it correlated to how much they loved dogs and had dogs in adulthood. Then they looked at twins who didn't have dogs for whatever reason. So their childhood wasn't shaped by dogs. And then looked to see in adulthood if they had dogs. And it came out, as stated, that it was way more significant. And people's love of dogs was more significant than how their environment was shaped as a child. So cool. So one of the conclusions that they make may contradict another study that said, you know, people who own a dog are more likely to live a healthier life. Well, now they're contending, well, maybe people have genetic traits that select them to pick a dog. And that genetic traits just makes them healthier on its own. So maybe it's more complicated than we thought. Now, the study didn't get into which specific genes were responsible. It didn't get into, you know, specifically looking at DNA. It just looked at genetics versus environment. It was statistically important. It was statistically significant that the DNA, the genes of these people, were more important than their environmental factors. And as one of the researchers said, a study, the co-author Patrick Magnuson, He said the next step is to try and identify which gene variants affect the choice and how they relate to your personality. And before we wrap up, I just want to talk about the implications of what it might mean that some of us have a genetic predisposition to love dogs. And maybe way in our past, because we've had dogs for 15,000 years at the minimum, right? 15,000 years we've been domesticating dogs. Maybe those people way in the past, because they love dogs or because they weren't scared of the dogs that were starting to be domesticated, had a better chance of survival. Remember, like, we domesticated dogs to work for us. They were a source of companionship. Of course they were a source of companionship like they are now, but they were also a source of stability food wise. They could help us hunt for food. They could protect us from danger. Early villages used different types of dogs to literally patrol the livestock and protect the people. Man, dogs are so good. And there's no stretch of the imagination that perhaps those societies which had more people that were better adjusted to living with dogs increased their family's chance of survival and thus passed on the gene that maybe I, you, everybody listening to the podcast has within their DNA to just freaking love dogs. And I just think that's amazing. I think that's so cool. Perhaps people's love of dogs is genetics. That may explain the passion behind dog Twitter. And we are talking to Matt Nelson today. And the following for wholesome and happy dogs on Twitter is enormous. And even for Bunsen, Bunsen's a much smaller account, but a lot of people follow Bunsen just because they love dogs. There's people out there who only are on Twitter to follow dogs. That may be a slightly more genetic predisposition than environmental. This report was published in the Journal of Scientific Reports. And that, for this week, was Dog Science. Hey everybody, we're just going to take a quick break to give you a little note from our sponsor, PLAY, which is a small business in San Francisco, California, with a mission to make things better for people and the planet and their pets. They sent Bunsen an adorable back-to-school set. You might have seen some pictures on social media. They sent him this tug-of-war rope with, I believe, they're Erlenmeyer flasks or boiling flasks. He just loves them. He's a science dog, but it's funny how much he loves the science toys. And there's like a big giant oversized calculator and like a diploma. It's just the cutest thing ever. The toys are such high quality. He loves playing with them. One of the cool things is that the filling inside the beds and their toys is actually made from recycled plastic bottles. And they've saved more than 4 million bottles from entering the landfill. What do you think about that, Bunsen? Bunsen, do you like the toys from Play? You do? Did you know they sent us a coupon code? Bunsen15, B-U-N-S-E-N 15, for 15% off everything at petplay.com? I know, it's amazing. And that website again is petplay.com. Check it out. They've got some awesome stuff. And now back to the show. Today on the Ask an Expert section of the podcast, we are so excited to have Matt Nelson from the Twitter accounts We Rate Dogs and Thoughts of Dog. Both of those accounts are enormous and they have a huge social media presence all over the world. J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame was quoted as saying We Rate Dogs is her favorite Twitter account. And without further ado, let's talk to Matt. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Matt.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is it kind of surreal how quickly your two Twitter accounts have grown in the last 2 or 3 years?
Oh yeah, it's ridiculous. Every time I think about it, I have to take a step back and realize how crazy it really is. It's been a blink as well.
Very quick, right?
Yeah, So I guess I'll go into the kind of the backstory of how it started and that quick growth.
Yeah, go ahead. Some people who listen to the podcast may not know the whole story behind the two Twitter accounts. That'd be great if you could, give us a little bit of history there.
Yeah, so I guess it was mid-2014, I first joined Twitter, and I really only used it as a creative outlet. Like I found this community of people that was using Twitter to write jokes and entertain their small audiences. And I kind of got addicted to that. And the character limits, like put a spin on it. I quickly fell in love with the platform as a whole. And then throughout the process of writing jokes and growing my own personal account, I realized that everyone loves dogs just as much as I did. Any joke that I made that had to do with dogs kind of probably did better than it should have. So it was kind of like that was the topic. That when I was ready to start something new, that was the topic I wanted to utilize. And I knew that I wanted to do it on Twitter because I'd already fallen in love with the platform. So yeah, it wasn't like a eureka moment where I was like, oh, I'm going to rate dogs. It was kind of like strategically figuring out what a bigger audience would enjoy. And dogs were definitely the topic. Rating them was kind of just like I knew that like I personally loved when things were assigned numeric value. And that was kind of like, I thought that was also a widespread notion and like having something that organizes all the posts and gives some consistency to the posts is definitely appealing. So that's kind of how the idea came about. And then I had almost 10,000 followers on my personal account to tell about, like to say like, hey, I made this account. Like, actually, I asked them, I was like, hey, should I make this dog rating Twitter account? And I actually did a poll. Like, this is when polls on Twitter were very new.
Yeah.
And everyone was very optimistic about it. So I made it and I passed myself in followers in like 3 days. And by the end of the month, I had 100,000 followers.
So you had 100,000 followers within a couple days?
By the end of that first month, yeah. And I think, it was just in part due to, there were cute animal accounts on Twitter, but no one had really taken advantage of the caption space. It was all either emojis or just like, oh my God, this is so cute in all caps. And coming from like a community that wrote jokes, I knew the importance of those 140 characters. I knew how valuable that space was and how valuable those words could be. So I paired that skill with the cute animals and the dog pictures. And it seemed to be a perfect storm that Twitter hadn't really seen yet. And that's all I can attribute to that initial growth. And then everything since has just been people like dogs. So, it just hasn't it hasn't stopped, which is absurd. I think it'll be 4 years in November and somehow people are still engaged with the account, which is crazy. Like, I didn't expect, like, most internet trends and memes and stuff come and go very quickly. And somehow my accounts have stuck around.
Well, I know from my personal experience with your accounts, is that, like, there's a side of Twitter that's just the worst, right? In fact, a lot of social media can have really negative vibes and connotations to it.
Absolutely.
And then, yeah, and your accounts are just so positive. Like, if somebody's having a rough day and they are like, oh, okay, and then they might have notifications set on for We Rate Dogs, and it's like just the most adorable picture with your witty writing. I think there's no stretch of the imagination to see why people connect so deeply with your accounts.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think that was something, like, it really started more with a goal of being humorous than with a goal of being wholesome. And
right.
Over time, as the audience grew, obviously not everyone's comedic tastes are the same. So I couldn't really rely on the humor as much anymore, but everyone can use something positive in their day. So it was a slow and gradual change from primarily humorous to primarily wholesome. And I think, I mean, throughout 2016, during the election times, it was really like everyone just needed something. And that's why people started to flock to my accounts. Like, that's when every 10th follower we got was a verified journalist just needing a break from the world. So,
oh, that's interesting you brought that up. I never thought of that. But yeah, like, they're, you know, if your job is to cover something like what happened in the States with 2016, I can imagine just the polarization and the toxicity. They just needed a break from that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's something that, like, I'm not just guessing that. People have DM'd me paragraphs saying, like, this is my utopia from like, aside from all the bad that's out there. So, I mean, to be that for people is super rewarding and not something that I like, that wasn't a goal of mine heading into this.
No, it's just a happy, happy conclusion, or, you know, a side effect, I guess. Hey,
absolutely.
So when you're running these accounts, I can imagine there's definitely some things that are rewarding, and maybe you could speak to some other things that you might find that has been so rewarding, but I'd imagine there's some pretty big challenges with running accounts that have millions of followers. Would you be able to speak to that? Like, some of the challenges, perhaps?
Yeah. So I'll start with a couple more of the rewarding things.
Yeah. Let's go positive first.
Well, so it was, let's see. I think it was late 2016 when we posted our first GoFundMe. And it was for dogs, or a dog that I had posted multiple times in the past. And that's why I not only trusted the owner, but I thought my audience would be quick to support the dog since they had already formed a connection with the dog via the past posts. So this dog, it was a little pug mix maybe, and he needed a wheelchair, and it was like $400. And I posted the GoFundMe and we raised it in like 40 minutes. And from that point on, I knew that was how my community could give back to, I don't know, the overarching dog world. And ever since then, we've been sent, I don't know, like 30 to 50 GoFundMes every week. And starting with the first Friday in 2017, I believe, we've posted one a week. Every Friday, there's a new campaign on the account that is taken from those that were sent. And I vet through all them and I contact the owner, make sure everything's legitimate. And GoFundMe also does a wonderful job of stopping all sorts of fraud and making sure each campaign is genuine, especially when it comes to,
right,
to the animal, I don't know, campaign bracket on their account. But it's been crazy to watch my community rally around those specific dogs. We've posted like 110, I believe, and 100% of them have hit their initial, like, financial targets, which is crazy because some of them are upwards of $15,000. And yeah, I think we're at almost $700,000 raised total, just via these individual GoFundMe campaigns. And that's something that, I mean, it's crazy to think about, but also I don't know how I fostered a community that, that cares that much, you know. That's, I mean, again, it just speaks to the love we have for dogs.
Yeah, that's so heartwarming. When and when you put the numbers out there, each family that your community and the community has helped with those GoFundMe, like that's somebody's pet, somebody's family member. And I know I follow We Rate Dogs, and it's life or death for some of those dogs. Like it's the difference between that dog being alive and not.
And yeah, this kind of, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, this kind of trickles into the challenges aspect of things, handling, like these are all very sensitive topics. Like, to, first of all, it's a very distinct break from the positive when I'm sharing a story about a dog that could pass away or that is going through something. Yeah. So that not only is that, it's a branch away from the normal content, but occasionally it's not a happy ending. And we've had times where I've had to, like, I've made the choice to skip the next week because the week prior, the dog didn't make it. And that's something where, like, usually tribute posts are not, like, I try not to do a ton of tribute posts. If I did, it would literally be one a day since we've posted so many dogs. With the GoFundMe specifically, it's like people not only have taken an emotional interest in this dog, but occasionally, like for some of the audience, they've taken a financial investment in the dog. And I feel like it's necessary to update my audience as a whole when there's a sad ending to those stories. And so occasionally, I mean, like that's a challenge in itself because, I mean, it's just sad. But yeah, I mean, we're sent, I mean, part of, I mean, I guess a decent transition is that we're sent so many stories and so many dogs every day. Like, I still think we're over 800 DMs a day, just dog pictures. And unfortunately, statistics means that a few of those comments are literally just people saying that, hey, sorry to let you know that my dog passed away today. And I have, like, I just scroll up and it's just a chronicle of the dog's life. It's like 3 years of pictures. Oh, wow. And so that's definitely like, that's not a challenge. Like that's not a typical challenge of the business side of things, but it's really just like personal. It's like, I was not built to deal with that on a regular basis.
I can't imagine. I'm so sorry to hear that. I can see why they would send you that, but just that must take an emotional toll on you after a while.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm not built to ever be numb to that either. Like you'd think that after a while I'd be like, oh, that, I mean, like I'd have this like normal response to it, but I don't, it like kills me every time. And so, yeah, that's not like, but there is a positive spin to that in that these people are so involved and engaged with the Twitter account that they feel the need to share that with me. And that, again, I don't know how I create a community that cares that much, but it, I mean, that means the world. Because even like something as simple as like sending me a picture of your dog, like you're in a way, like in a weird way that is only relatable to dog owners, like you're sharing a part of your family with me, especially if you give me paragraphs on paragraphs about the dog and about why you love your dog, like that that means the world. And it's only fitting and it makes sense that after you've done that, that you want to let me know that the dog is no longer around. So I get it. It's just not, it's definitely a challenge because it's not something that I ever expected to be a part of the account and not something that I'll ever get used to in a way.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think a lot of people don't know that side of your Twitter accounts. And that's one of the reasons why I guess I was getting a little bit of insight is important for everybody.
Yeah. It's obviously it's not a fun thing to talk about, but I think there is a positive to it. Like I mentioned that people just feel so comfortable with the account. Like somehow I've created this environment where people are anxious to share, which is great in so many ways. The other challenges that come with it are just the pressure of having a worldwide audience that is like at your fingertips. The other day I had, well, actually it was at the time of recording this, it was yesterday, that it was dog day, and I posted the, hey, reply with a pic of your dog.
Yep.
And it got 60,000 replies. And in the process of sharing with my personal audience that we had like, or that we were approaching breaking a record for the most replies on a tweet for dog rates, I shared the impressions, and it was like, I think it was 5.5 million at the time, which is right wow. along, like that is probably slightly higher than our average impressions per post. And someone commented and they're like, I can't imagine the pressure associated with 5.5 million people seeing a tweet, and then responding with a gif of like just a panic attack. And I commented and I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I've been having a constant panic attack since I first logged into the account. And that's true. It's just an overwhelming amount of pressure that is not like, it's not normal. Like, I think I sometimes get lost in this world of like, oh, there are a ton of influencers that deal with having to please an audience 24/7, but that's not normal. Like, no, that is not the normal life. Like, that is not the normal user experience for someone on Twitter. So that in itself, like, I don't think we have time to dive into the nuances of that pressure, but yeah, it's just like to have, not only is it a sense of responsibility, but it's like, I am such a people pleaser in a way. And that's obvious with my content, like yep. it's built for mass appeal. But like, if I have a sense that the audience on either account is not content, then that pressure is just exponential. Like, then there's pressure to make a post that fixes that almost like reintroduces the account to people in a positive way. But yeah, I don't know if there's a specific thing you want me to dive into regarding that pressure, but it's kind of crazy to think about. And again, not something, it's like a side effect of success, which is just weird. Like, all of this is just so weird. But yeah, I it's definitely like, not only some of the challenges have to do with like, oh, literally if I like have a typo, the accounts are to the point where I can't repost that ever. Because Twitter has the, like, regardless of how soon you delete a post, it lingers on the timeline. And if it's 10 seconds, well, that's 100,000 people that have already seen it. So like, I can't, if I were to just delete and re-upload, it doesn't have like, it just doesn't have that effect. And so it's like a one and done opportunity. And that's just one of the simple challenges. And then you get into like, oh, well, like I went through, this is again, probably 2016, early 2017, where like I felt very constricted with the content because I was trying to please everyone. And this is at a time where Twitter was, and social media as a whole, was very divisive. So like, I just couldn't please everyone.
Yeah.
So not only did I have to like tone down my own creativity, but like, I don't know, it was really just like figuring out how to make content that appealed to the audience that I wanted to appeal to. So yeah, that, I mean, all of the challenges you would expect that come with having an audience, I've experienced. And then at the same time, trying to turn social media into a more traditional business. Like, obviously I don't think Twitter is going to be around forever, and I would like to still be able to eat if it goes away. So we're in the process of building out a business model that would make that possible. But like, my priority will always be making sure that the content on the account is fantastic. And that's harder to do when I'm spread thin, like trying to build out other parts of the business, like the merchandise or partnerships or consulting, stuff like that. So,
or doing a random podcast.
Or doing a random podcast. So yeah, the challenge, like that's probably the most relatable challenge, or the most current challenge too, is making sure the content stays as good as it's always been while building a larger company at the same time.
Yeah. People follow your accounts and maybe they don't see that the person that's running it is just a real person, just like everybody else. And
I'm actually a dog. So,
oh, right. Okay. Sorry.
That was another thing. Like, people kind of get lost in this world where it's a dog rating other dogs. And obviously with Thoughts of Dog, it's like, you want to get lost in this world where it's literally the thoughts of a dog. So like, and I don't want to ruin that experience for anyone. So that adds to the pressure. Like I gotta stay on brand in most scenarios or I jeopardize that. It's also difficult because people don't see a human behind the account. They feel like they can give, like, well, they can give any sort of feedback, but occasionally it's not with the consideration that there is a person on the other end of it. So yeah, I guess that's another challenge. But again, the positive spin is that it allows people to get lost in a very fun world.
It's almost like a fantasy, right? Like it's people put themselves on Twitter and they look at your accounts, and for a brief moment in time, they're having or they're listening to or reading the thoughts of an actual dog. And I think that's really cool. You know, it's
absolutely
it's no different than watching a Marvel movie and seeing somebody fly around, right? That's a different part of a fantasy, and that's really
good. I'm honored by that comparison.
There you go. We might get to that a little later. Before we move on to the next question, I thought it was really cool. And you made a comment on the account yesterday, because it was International Dog Day, that Adam Savage of MythBusters posted his dog.
I guess he has two dogs. Commented two separate times.
Which is really cool. You're a little bit younger, but you probably grew up with the craze of the MythBusters.
Absolutely. It was my life. I knew when it came on, there was a time, like it was probably several summers in a row where I watched it every day. So yeah, that's just one of those experiences that I'm like, oh, well, this could never happen unless I started this dog rating Twitter account. I could never interact with someone at that scale if not for literally Twitter.
It's very cool. And I imagine you take solace in all of those little positive bits overwhelm some of the negative or the challenges that you have.
Oh, absolutely. I think I always cite this comic, and I really should figure out who it's by, but it's basically this little stick figure sitting at a table and he's looking at his phone, and there's all these positive comments and reviews above his head, and there's one negative one, and throughout the day all the positive ones go away and the negative one gets like brighter. That is very much my life, but I've gotten to the point where like I can step back into reality and be like, all right, yeah, it's the comments are overwhelmingly positive. I don't need to concern myself with the negative.
Yeah. Well, let's move to something that's really positive. We always ask our guests on the podcast to talk about a memorable pet story. Do you have one that you could share with everybody?
Yeah. I have a bunch, but I think the one that is the most interesting is when we found a corgi. Like we had so this was back when I was living in West Virginia with my two Goldens and my family. And we had like really bad storms one night. And the next morning my mom went out for a run. And as she was coming back, she passed this corgi in the middle of the road that was definitely out all night in the storm. Aww. And she brought him home. And I was still asleep, and she yells up the stairs, "Matt, I found a puppy." And I was like, oh my God. Like, and so I ran downstairs, and in our yard, just roaming around, was this corgi. And I was like, this is the greatest day ever. So we brought him inside, and he wasn't a puppy, but we thought he was probably like 4 or 5 years old. We found out later he was 11 years old.
Oh my goodness.
So it was a senior corgi lost in a storm in an area where like you don't just see corgis roaming around Charleston, West Virginia. Like you see labs and the occasional golden, but a corgi is like very, very rare in West Virginia. So we got him inside and I was like, all right, I'm taking pictures of this dog and I'm going to put him on the account, because not only is everyone going to love that I found like a corgi, just he happened into my home, but we can definitely find his owner via the accounts. So I put him on the account, and at first people didn't realize that they thought I was posting it on behalf of someone else. Like I was taking pictures of a corgi, like someone had just sent me them and I was trying to get the corgi found. But later it was clear, like, nope, I am the one that found the corgi. So we brought him to the vet. He wasn't chipped. But so we were just like, we just put him in the car and we started driving around where we found him. And we figured, my mom for some reason was like, you know what, I bet it's like an old couple's corgi. And I was like, why would you jump to that conclusion? And as she was saying that, this old man in like a blue Lincoln drove by us. And she was like, you know what, I'm going to go ask him. It looked like he had his windows rolled down. He was driving slow. It looked like he could be looking for something. So we turned around and he had stopped just down the road. And my mom just got out of the car and went up to his window and was like, hey, are you looking for a dog? And he was like, yes. And that's how we found the owner. So it had nothing to do with me posting it on social media. Literally us going out there, like corgi in hand, trying to find the owner was what worked. And so, yeah, that's probably my favorite story, because like, what are the chances that a lost dog like just waddles into the house of someone with 8 million followers because of like dog stories? So yeah, that's definitely the coolest thing that happened. I saw a comment that summed it up really well. And it was like, a dog wandering into the home of the dog rates guy is like me being lost in the desert and stumbling upon Gordon Ramsay. So it's like, I don't know. I thought that whole story was hilarious just because of the coincidence of not only it being a corgi, which obviously the entire internet loves, but it being me trying to find the owner.
Yeah, that's super cool story. Moms and their mom radar, their spidey sensor. I tell you, there's something there. I think scientists has got to get on that.
No, absolutely. Yeah, my mom is fabulous. She's the reason I've been like, not only like my parents have been super supportive throughout this entire journey, but yeah, she's incredible, and I couldn't believe that she was right about that. I was like, you can't just stereotype like that. And she's like, no, I really think this is the owner.
And probably not, not saying that older folks aren't on Twitter, but less are, and probably not your demographic of the guy that was driving around either. So
exactly. It was actually his grandson that messaged me later that day with an update on Pepper, which was the dog's name, saying that.
Oh, I remember this now. Yes, I remember this.
Yeah, yeah. So I was able to get updates on the dog through him later on.
What an adorable, heartwarming story. Thank you so much for sharing.
Of course. Yeah. Well, I'm thankful that I got to share that with my entire audience as well. I think I put it in our like Dogs of 2018 recap because it was just such an interesting thing that happened.
There you go. So when you're not, rating dogs within proper fractions or coming up with some really creative content, what does Matt do for fun? Like as a normal person, what do you do to unwind?
So, I mean, I will emphasize that is a small portion of my time. And unfortunately, like I spend way too much time just working, especially as things get more complicated outside of simply the content on Twitter. But I love, I don't know, I guess media in all forms would be the best way to describe it. Like I am huge into every streaming service and all the shows and movies that debut on them. Like I am embarrassingly well-versed in Netflix. like I think that coming from the perspective of someone that creates content and writes on the internet, I just have a huge respect for anyone that does it in other forms of media. Like I like directors of shows and movies I'm so fascinated by just because they do what I do on a much larger scale and in a medium that I find interesting. So yeah, I mean, I spend, unfortunately, which is probably not good for my brain, the unwinding is still done via the internet and on a device, which is probably not healthy, but that's definitely a large portion of me reclaiming some like stress relief, I guess. And then for a while, and I really need to get back into it, I actually went to school for professional golf management. Like golf was kind of my life for a really long time. And it's like, yeah, it's like 4 hours on a golf course away from my phone is kind of like a fantasy right now, but I can't wait to get back to it because it does just so much for my mental health. So yeah, hopefully I get to the point where everything is manageable enough where I can take that time back and use it in a way that isn't still on my phone. So yeah, I mean, I'd say that though, I mean, like really, and I've also like I've gotten big into going to the gym, which I think is kind of like that. I think it's way more for my mental health than my physical health at this point. Like, I just need that break away from everything to like blow off steam, I guess. But yeah, so not much outside of working, but those are the few things that I do or hope to continue to do that have helped this whole thing.
Yeah, we had a psychology professor on the last podcast, and what she said and what you're doing is very important, this disconnecting.
Yes.
And even if you're watching Netflix, that's still a disconnect from your day job, and that's really important for your mental health. Are you do you watch the comedies on Netflix or like what's your go-to show?
Really anything. Like, I'm a big fan of John Mulaney and Bo Burnham, so obviously I've watched their stand-ups like 10 times over. But really, like, I don't think there's a specific genre. Like, I already finished the new Mindhunter. I love that style of show. Well, I love Fincher. Like, all his movies I'm obsessed with. So as soon as he was making a show, I knew that I was going to love it. But even like Gossip Girl, like, I don't know, I'm fascinated by shows like that as well. So really it's anything and everything. I think really most shows on streaming services are like just putting traditional television in the dirt. Like, I can't tell you a show that is on cable right now that even competes with what is available on HBO or Netflix or Hulu.
Yeah, those streaming services certainly changed media so quickly and rapidly.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that even the more like the near future dystopian ones like Black Mirror and Handmaid's Tale, like, I guess that would be my favorite genre, just because I can just see how near dystopian they are, and that's just really fascinating to me.
My a lot of my high school students, they love Black Mirror, just because they're younger and they've grown up with the technology, so they see it as more of a reality than somebody who's a little older like me that sees it as science fiction, which is kind of scary when you think of it.
Oh yeah, that show was revolutionary in that regard. And then I hope they continue to make episodes that are like that do deal with like the almost current topics, because it's very interesting.
Well, we're almost at the end of the podcast interview. One of the last questions we ask is the super fact. The super fact for you can be anything that you know that when you tell somebody, it kind of like just like blows their mind a bit. Do you have a super fact you could share?
Is it just in general or about myself?
No, it's anything. Like, if I have a scientist on, like a paleontologist, then their super fact would be about dinosaurs.
Oh God!
But your super fact can be about anything.
Well, just hearing you say that, it's actually very funny how many people ask the account for like very serious vet advice, like their dog is having a problem, and they're like, "Yo, I was just wondering if you knew like any like good treatments for hot spots." And I'm like, I am not a vet. Like, I am just here to entertain you. I don't actually know much about dogs. The only information I have about dogs is what I've gained from like living with one for my whole life. I don't actually I haven't done research into these topics, but people, if they take the account somewhat more literally than others, they definitely think that I am some sort of professional. And so they ask me very serious questions about their dog. And I have to tell them that I actually don't know much.
You're good about the rating, but not so much about the physiology.
Exactly. Well, I thought the super fact was about myself. So I was just going to say,
oh, yeah, if you have a super fact about yourself, go for it.
All right. Well,
people would be fascinated to learn more about
you. Yeah. So I had open heart surgery at 5 days old.
Oh my goodness.
And I go back to that same doctor every year, and everything's fine now. I have like a heart murmur, and that's it. That's why I go back every year, to just make sure everything's in order. But recently, so I was one of the first babies, I guess, to have that specific type of surgery. And so just now, over the course of studying similar cases throughout the years, they've learned like what personality style kids that have had this surgery have. And it's like weirdly consistent, just based on the surgery I needed. I guess I'm gonna butcher this explanation, but while I was in the womb, I was getting more blood to my brain than like the average baby because of the problem with my heart. So they're just learning that that lends itself to a more like creative type of individual, I guess. So yeah, my super fact would be that part of the reason I'm creating content on the internet is because my heart was messed up when, before, as I was being assembled. So
that's a great fact. That's amazing. I'm just kind of speechless. I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah.
When you work out, do you have any irregular heartbeat, or is it completely like you're just like Joe Normal Guy?
I'm Joe Normal Guy, and I have been since really the only recommendation from the doctor after that point was to make sure that I still had like I kept up with like aerobic type exercises. So I mean, I was a big swimmer as well. Like I mentioned golf, but swimming was also my life throughout middle school, high school. But there's not really a career in swimming. So that's why I went with golf when I went to college. But yeah, so swimming, not only did I get obsessed with the sport and I made it my life, but that was what kept me very healthy and made it so that they weren't concerned about my heart because I was doing this level of activity so frequently. So yeah, all good now. And I really just, like I said, I go back every year just to make sure everything's still functioning normally. But I just thought it was interesting that they're just now learning what, like, I don't know if you call it like predispositions or like that where I'm more susceptible to, like, and just learning like that because of this problem back in the day, I'm wired a certain way is just really fascinating. And I mean, hopefully they learn more.
Yeah, it's that whole nature versus nurture thing in science, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So your nature perhaps, like you said, predisposed you to have a certain skill set that the world, I guarantee you, though, I mean, it probably really sucked for your parents when you were so little, but the world now is benefiting from that with your two Twitter accounts.
Yeah, and like a little branch from that is that my birthday is 10/10. So maybe it was like prophetic that I was supposed to rate things. I don't know.
Oh, look, there you go. I love that. Brilliant. We're at the end of the podcast. I know you're so busy. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Of course.
Obviously, you have two huge Twitter accounts. People who are listening will know what they are. You have some, you have a merchandise line. Where can people find that?
Yeah. So we actually just launched our 2020 calendars. There's actually four different things you can get for 2020. There's a Thoughts of Dog planner where like there's a Thoughts of Dog every week on the bottom right hand corner. And then there's a day-to-day calendar for Thoughts of Dog. So literally every day you can tear off a page and there's a new Thoughts of Dog, which is like more consistent than the Twitter account posts. So it's a wonderful product. And then We Rate Dogs, just like last year, has a wall calendar and a day-to-day calendar. The day-to-day as well, like literally a dog every day. And we got wonderful feedback on that last year. I think we have, and since they're tear away, people did really cool things with the pages they tore away. Like they literally plastered them all over a single wall. And so there's dogs all over their wall because they couldn't fathom actually throwing the page away. So yeah, those are the new things that I guess that the most recent things we've launched. And then, yeah, our regular merchandise can be found at weratedogs.com.
Super cool. We're excited to get that board game that you guys made too, which looks hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was actually like a few games because I know nothing about developing a game or making a game work. So I had a few gentlemen like contact me and they're like, hey, we want to make a We Rate Dogs game. And I was like, well, not without me. So I just wrote the copy for that and they made the game work. So yeah, it's pretty fun. It's a little complicated, but at the end of the day, like you can just look at the dogs and look at their ratings and make your own game out of it. So
any new board game is always complicated. I don't know if you've ever tried to explain Monopoly to somebody for the first time, but it is an exercise in frustration. So I can't imagine your board game is any more complicated. All right. Well, you know what? Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. One of the things just to mention is that your account has such a huge megaphone and you do promote such a wholesome image of the world. And I think, and you probably get messages just how positive and how much it's changed people's days and their outlook with mental health. And just from our family, we want to thank you for doing that for everybody and for us too, because we're big fans of your account.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you for saying that. And when we get similar messages, like, I struggle not to just be like, yeah, well, I'm crying now. Thank you. but yeah, that means a lot and I appreciate it.
Well, it's genuine. So you take care. Yeah. You have a good day. We'll keep looking for more and more of your rates and your thoughts of dogs. And this has been a really fascinating discussion, and people hopefully who are listening will know there's a real person behind the account. And that's part of social media, is the empathy thing, that if you know that there's a real person behind the account, then you can put yourself perhaps in their shoes on a day-to-day basis too.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
Alrighty.
Having me anytime.
Talk to you later, Matt. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's time for Woo or Wow. And this edition is all about dogs. In Woo or Wow, I'll be giving you three statements. Two of them will be woo, they will be fake, and one of them will be true. Here we go. The most popular breed of dog in the United States for the last 25 years has been the Golden Retriever. Okay. Interesting. Dachshunds were bred to hunt and fight badgers. Badgers are pretty fierce. Bunsen and I got chased by a badger just the other day. Now, the United States has long been known to have the most amount of dogs in it. It's getting close to 80 million. But this city has the most dogs per person. And that city is Tokyo. Okay, let's do a quick little recap. The first fact was the most popular breed in the United States for the last 30 years has been the Golden Retriever. Statement number two. Dachshunds were bred to fight and hunt badgers. And statement three. While the United States has the most number of dogs, the city with the most dogs per capita is Tokyo. Okay, think about it. Bum, 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 bum. Time's up. All right, let's pick one. The city with the most dogs per capita is not Tokyo. The city with the most dogs per capita, that's the most dogs per person, is actually Tel Aviv in Israel. Crazy, hey? Tel Aviv, if you want to have a quick snapshot of where Tel Aviv is, Tel Aviv sits on kind of the western side of Israel, and it's very close, or, you know, has very easy access to the Mediterranean Sea. Interesting, hey? That leaves two left. One is that dachshunds were bred to hunt badgers. And the other one was that golden retrievers were the most popular dog breed for the last 30 years. And the one that is woo is the golden retriever one. The golden retriever hasn't been the most popular breed in the United States. The most popular breed is the Labrador. They're cute. I love Labradors. They're so friendly. That leaves, shocking, especially if maybe you knew this, if you have yourself a dachshund. Dachshunds were bred to hunt and fight badgers. Crazy. Dachshunds are just little guys, but they were bred to hunt and fight badgers. One of the reasons why they're so good at it is because of their small, elongated shape. They could go after tongueling animals, even like foxes. I found that really interesting. So that's Dog Woo or Wow for this week. How did you do? If you didn't do so hot, don't worry. You can try again next week. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast episode. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I am fighting a cold and Adam is fighting a really bad cold. So we're going to hold off on the mailbag until we sound normal for next week. We're going to give a quick shout out to our top tier patrons from Patreon who make running the podcast so much easier. Here they are: Andrea Persons, Liz Button, Ben Rathert, Bianca Hyde, Chris Hemhold, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, and finally Kathleen Zucher. Thank you so much for your support. And I'm going to give a quick shout out to Tailblazers in Red Deer. We've partnered with Tailblazers to do some social media sharing. Tailblazers is so friendly and so fun for Bunsen to go to. It's where we get his dog food. We were out of dog food the other day, and Chris took Bunsen into Tailblazers, and everybody there was so happy to see him, and Bunsen's waggling his tail, and they answer all of our questions. It's just a great place. If you're in Central Alberta, check out Tailblazers. Finally, we'd just like to thank Matt Nelson from We Rate Dogs and Thoughts of Dogs for coming on our podcast. It's so cool he said yes, and it was such a good conversation. And I hope it gets across in the medium just how awesome of a person he is. So thanks, Matt. Next week on the podcast, we have a citizen scientist who's actually also a forensic accountant. And in her spare time, she captures alligators and helps take their blood. It's a crazy interesting hobby, along with her very interesting full-time job. I hope you tune in next week. So let's end with Bunsen's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.